Welcome to Canadian Politique. I'm Cameron Bishop.
I'm Leanne Goodman.
I'm Mike McDougall.
And today on the show, well, we're back after our long summer of erratic schedules, but we are back now. We're going to be talking about the notwithstanding clause being used in Ontario for the first time ever to ram changes to Toronto City Council's through the legislature. We're going to talk briefly about Bob Woodward's book, Stories of the Week, and of course, because today is September 11th, we will... I want to kind of talk about where we were 17 years ago today. But first, Mike and Leanne, you both are in Toronto. Do you feel democratically challenged this afternoon?
Yes.
Angry?
Not angry, but I guess I have a real character flaw that I assume people aren't going to be dicks for no reason.
Right.
And I assume this of Doug Ford. I thought, well, once he gets in power, he's not going to be as bad as we think he's going to be. And he has been.
Yeah, turns out he's worse.
And also dumb. Like the whole quote in the news conference, well, I can't believe that one appointed judge can go against me and I was elected. It's like, well, I guess so. Did you skip civics class? Like, do you not understand how government works and the role of the judiciary? Like,
we have that quote, Leanne. We have that quote, and we're going to play it just so we have the premier here on the show. Go for it.
We have instructed our legal counsel to immediately commence appeal proceedings to the Ontario Court of Appeal. I have already called an emergency meeting of my cabinet to discuss this response, and I have notified the Lieutenant Governor our intention to bring back the legislature back this week. Our first order of business will be to reintroduce the Better Local Government Act and with it invoke Section 33 of the Constitution.
Mr. Premier, the judge gave you a royal smackdown in Bill 5, a royal smackdown, saying it was unconstitutional, crossed the line. Your government, you are acting out of pique, and there's no evidence counsel is dysfunctional. Are you worried that, and yet you are choosing to ignore it, to squash his ruling, are you worried you're going to be described as a dictator? Are you acting like a dictator yourself?
Well, let me tell you something. I was elected. The judge was appointed. Was appointed by one person, Dalton McGuinty.
Wrong.
I was elected by 2.3 million people. And let me be very clear. I respect the courts. I have the
yes.
ultimate respect for courts.
Yes, he does. You see.
Ultimate respect for judges. But it's very, very concerning when all the legal experts across the country.
Yeah, he goes on about legal experts, whatever. Well, this is what happens, Ontario, when you get a high school dropout who subsequently dropped out of Humber College and self-admitted didn't have the grades for university, becomes premier. You have a boob who can't even figure out that the judge who was appointed by the judge appointed who ruled against him was actually a federal appointment. Premiers don't make judicial appointments at the provincial level. So well done, Doug. And why does it always sound like somebody's got his balls in a grip?
Mostly, he sounds like a carnival barker.
All right, Chewy.
We've said it on the pod here, though, where, you know, like Doug Ford, when he got elected, he did all the easy stuff that a premier can do, like make buck a beer, which didn't even happen.
Right.
It's friggin' hilarious. He couldn't even do that. He could even
make
beer.
We got it for a week, Mike. We got it for a week.
It was for a long weekend. And then President's Choice craftily pulled out, but they made sure that they got their name on there so they were able to sell pot in their grocery stores and that becomes legal. And Doug will be like, oh, yeah, you gave me buck a beer. We said on this pod that when governing actually has to be governed by, you know, politics and, you know, the actual governance of a province, that he's not going to be able to do it. And this proves that he can't. He's said also, and we haven't discussed this yet, that he's willing to invoke the notwithstanding clause several times if he has to, you know, enforce what he wants. And that's a pretty scary thing, in my opinion. I understand that the notwithstanding clause is there and that's what it's for. But aside from, you know, Quebec, who use it for racist reasons, you know, Saskatchewan's the only province that ever did it. And that was 30 years ago for a labor dispute. So what Doug is doing here is really unprecedented, and I know it's getting a ton of coverage, but it's not cool, and it's very concerning that it's happening, and I think that we should be a bit more upset about it, even though it's well within his rights to do it.
Yeah, even Brian Mulroney, whose daughter Caroline Mulroney is Ford's attorney general, even Brian Mulroney came out today and said that he thinks it's a problem when a premier basically denies rights to the citizens. And that's what really has happened here. This isn't about, better local government. This is about a man who is pissed off that his former colleagues on council didn't bend to his will and to his brother's will. And so he's decided that what he's going to do is he's going to take a round out and kick the shit out of them any way he wants to kick them. But I think you're right, Mike. Like, it is totally scary when he's sitting there saying that on everything else he'd be prepared to use a notwithstanding clause. So where does it end? So today it's municipal government and effective representation. Tomorrow is it the sex ed curriculum if the courts overturn the decision? Is it gay marriage? Is it abortion rights in the province of Ontario? Where does it end? And this man claiming a mandate, 2.3 million people. Hey, Doug, that's 40% of the individuals who voted. So 55% of Ontarians voted. 40% of that 55 elected Doug Ford. Fine.
And none of them were from Toronto.
No, apparently not. But that's only 23% of the total population of Ontario. And yet he said, 2.3 million Ontarians. Yeah, and like 11 million told you to shove it up your ample ass. It's very frightening. Leanne, I think I would be worried if I was a woman.
Oh, I am. You know that. You know I think that they're coming for us and it's going to be a Handmaid's Tale situation. Strangely enough, at the conversation, I had edited what I found to be an extremely boring piece in the winter on the notwithstanding clause. And basically the thrust of the piece was, is it's rarely used because everybody knows it's an unfair shakedown of the rules. Like,
that's
it's the cheap, right? It's the cheap way out. Like,
it's throwing a bomb is what it is.
Yeah.
It's throwing a bomb.
I don't like it. So we're just going to, I've decided that I'm not going to do it. Strangely enough, that other politician who I am no longer a fan of, who's no longer in power, Brad Wall, he's threatened to use it. And there's an ongoing court battle in Saskatchewan where it may still be used. Quebec is starting to whisper about using it over the NICAB debate. Because they've been told that it's unconstitutional, the NICAB ban, and so they may. You know what is scary about it is if he starts it going, maybe all sorts of other provinces, especially with populist premiers like him, will start doing it.
Or like Jason Kenney.
Jason Kenney
is looking at this now.
Exactly.
I still think Rachel Notley is going to pull it out of the fire in the end because Kenney's been stepping on a lot of different landmines of his own making. But should he be elected? This is a man who has decried every opportunity for equal rights for LGBTQ communities, women, you name it, he's against it. And when you start playing around, like you say, both of you have said, with the notwithstanding clause, it's a very slippery slope before the rights of the many have been taken away because of the governing few.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also, I like how you likened it to a bomb, but really what it is it's a fire alarm, right? It's an emergency situation for the premier to use should an emergency come up and, a leader needs to lead, so to speak. I mean, excuse the metaphors there, but, what he's doing is he's pulling a fire alarm because he wants to get revenge on a council that rejected him. And that's just the most petty thing. It's actually pretty awesome with how petty it is from, like, if I was an outsider, but the fact that I live in this province, it's scary as hell. And, we have a very petty premier, and that's demonstrative by him using the notwithstanding clause over a goddamn council size of a municipality. Like, what's he doing? Like, why don't you drink more buck of beer, Doug, and, like, figure something else to worry about?
Well, the thing is that council debate, too. Like, first of all, Ford did say, I'll give him a modicum of credit, except that it's worthless words coming out of his mouth. He said it's going to be a free vote. My MPP, Marilee Fullerton, is a PC member. She's the Minister of Training and Universities. I don't think she has any damn business voting on a bill that would reformat Toronto City Council. You want a free vote, Doug? Then how about this? Ask every MPP in that chamber that is not a Toronto MPP to recuse themselves and allow a free vote among the MPPs from Toronto. He would lose it in a landslide. So he's got all these friggin' people around the province who have no idea what the local needs are in Toronto, and frankly don't care. This is just a way to kind of shove a stick up Toronto's ass and to laugh at the quote unquote elites. And in the end, they are going to foist their idea on the citizens of Toronto to their detriment.
Well, and the other thing is, if I'm not a citizen of Toronto and I voted for Rob Ford, I might be getting kind of annoyed that he's spending so much time obsessing over and fixating on the city of Toronto. Right?
Yeah.
Like what, I voted for you to so you could pick big constitutional battles with the city of Toronto? Really? There's a lot of other things in this province that I voted for you for, right? So I don't get it. It's obviously some petty personal thing. It's, I mean, we knew that anyway, but clearly it's more so than I thought. I actually thought that he had an easy out because it seemed obvious that the courts weren't going to let him do it. I thought, okay, you've made your point. You've scared a lot of people. You've made Tory look like an even bigger weakling than we already thought he was, right? He made Tory look terrible. And, okay, you've made your point. The court's ruled against you. Just drop it. I thought he'd drop it. I was really shocked yesterday to hear that he was going taking the nuclear option. But what I'm still unclear about, and I'm trying to actually get a story on this right now, is what happens now?
Nothing.
Does it go all the way to the Supreme Court?
It wouldn't matter.
He just opts out.
No, the Supreme Court cannot overturn the notwithstanding clause.
Right,
so
right.
He's appealing it. So he's appealing it to the Federal Court of Appeal.
By citing that.
Yeah, so
fighting the notwithstanding clause.
No. It's both. It's both. So he's appealing the ruling as a means to try and get a court ruling. But the notwithstanding clause, he's going to put it in there anyway. So regardless of how the ruling goes, he'll still be able to do it. No court, no federal legislature, no federal parliament, nothing can stop him from doing it. The only thing is that it's got a 5-year expiry. So the next government would have to renew this notwithstanding clause in 5 years. So if he's there in 4 years and he wins another term, then he's going to have to renew it. And every subsequent government, regardless of stripe, would have to do the same. So it's quite plausible that you're going to be in a situation where Toronto will have its representation back to a different size council. But I don't understand. I mean, like, what's the rush? Why not just say it's going to be 47 councillors and we'll move to 25? Come on.
You'll still be in power in 3 years. So, you know, to go for it for the next election. Like, why a month before or 2 months before the vote? Is it how many months?
Why is the premier of the province worrying about this? Like, that's why we have a mayor.
Crazy.
Well, if anybody that didn't vote, I'd actually like to thank the 45% of Ontarians who decided that they were too busy to vote. Thanks a lot. Well done. And for those of you who thought that listening to Kathleen Wynne, because this is, let's be honest, the Liberals can under Wynne enjoy a good, healthy dose of blame for why we have Doug Ford. If she had left 2 years earlier when the poll numbers were in the toilet, if she hadn't, you know, screwed around on attack ads with the NDP in the final weeks of the election, if she hadn't done that stupid strategic voting initiative that pulled the Liberals to 7 seats and still lost official party status, I think we might have had a different premier and a different outcome. Because nobody wanted Doug Ford, at least not the ones who think and breathe and eat and work intelligently.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's just a piss off. I don't understand what the rush is, but I do think that at some point, you're right, that this obsession with Toronto is going to hurt him. I mean, now he's talking about redeveloping Ontario Place. A few months ago, I remember when he was first elected, he was saying, Toronto has the best police in the province. Well, Doug, you're not the premier just of Toronto. There are thousands of men and women across this province who defend us every day, and they're no less than the individuals who serve in Toronto. It's unbelievable. But I think we should be scared, and if you want to do something, you should be looking at ways to fight back against the government. Of course, we can't really do anything when it comes to the notwithstanding clause, but we can, you know, burn up the phone lines to PC reps. And so I would encourage everybody that maybe has a PC MPP who represents them, like me, call their office. Maybe if they feel enough pressure about, you know, a constitutional bomb throwing by a petulant prick of a premier. Wow, that's like Peter Piper picked a pepper or whatever. I don't know. I really enjoyed those three P's. But if that petulant, prick wants to get his way, he still has to go through the legislature. And maybe, I doubt it, but maybe there are enough MPPs in there, if you call them on the PC side, who will vote against the premier. Maybe they'll grow a pair and they'll grow.
They won't.
No, they won't. So
not this early in his term. No way.
Well, I would also just like to give a special shout out to Caroline Mulroney, her own father said that the notwithstanding clause is basically, it should not even be in the Constitution because of the...
Yeah, no, it shouldn't have been.
It, should, it shouldn't.
It never should have been. It's interesting. It's all about the light and night of the long knives, which is an unusually fascinating and brutal episode in Canadian history engineered by Jean Chrétien. It's a pretty interesting story. Like, they cooked it up in the dead of night without Quebec's knowledge as a way to get everybody in to sign on to the charter. So
that's right.
Anyway, it's interesting.
He doesn't like
good
it.
Good job, but Jean Chrétien. I wonder what Chrétien said, actually. I'd love to hear what Chrétien has to say, because he played a big role in the notwithstanding clause. That's why Mulroney's shitting on it.
Well, that's right? It. It's 50-year-old. That's right. 30-year-old political battles, and Brian Mulroney's out there. But, I mean, it's got to be awkward for Caroline.
His daughter, though, so how weird.
But you know what? I'll give him this. Good on him. He said he thinks it's a problem, but he wouldn't say specifically, but everybody knows what he's referring to. At any rate,
funny.
Let's move on to something remotely scarier, but it also, again, is more about rights. This time, the constitutional right of the president's cabinet and the U.S. government to keep the president in check. Bob Woodward, of course, the famous Bob Woodward, the Washington Post journalist, who is one of the ones who uncovered Watergate, widely respected, released or pre-released, I guess, his book Fear, about the Trump White House this past week. Lots of good things in that book. I actually can't wait to read it. I've read a few of the excerpts that have come out. Among them, he has, I should say as an aside, he for himself says that in terms of one source on one story, he has 700 to 800 pages of notes from that one source. So this is not a man who is making things up. Everything has been referenced in terms of the people, the place, the time, and who were saying what. The sources in the book are anonymous, so to speak. But what we do know is that there are individuals in the White House that are calling the president out, including his chief of staff in the book. John Kelly, the president's chief of staff, is quoted as saying, "Trump is an idiot. It's pointless to try to convince him of anything. He's gone off the rails. We're in crazy town. I don't even know why any of us are here. This is the worst job I've ever had." then there was an exchange between the president's lawyer and the president when he was trying to prepare Trump for testifying before Bob Mueller. And he says that you are not a good witness, Mr. President. I'm afraid I just can't help you. And then he apparently this president's lawyer has also told Mueller that why he didn't want Trump to testify was because he wasn't going to sit there and let him look like an idiot. And then he says, and you published that transcript because everything leaks in Washington and the guys overseas are going to say, I told you he was an idiot. I told you he was a goddamn dumbbell. What are we dealing with this idiot for? This same lawyer also reportedly, it's Dowd, also reportedly referred to Trump as a fucking liar. Oh, and the defense secretary is quoted as saying that Trump has the mental capacity of a grade 5 student.
Tonight, President Trump calling Bob Woodward's bombshell new book a joke on Twitter. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders.
It seems like a very careless and reckless way to write a book.
Woodward defending his book on Today.
It is mostly anonymous sources in here. Why should people trust you?
But the incidents are not anonymous. It gives a date, it gives a time, who participates.
In Fear, Woodward details anecdotes that include Chief of Staff John Kelly calling the president an idiot and Defense Secretary James Mattis saying Mr. Trump has the understanding of a fifth or sixth grader.
John Kelly aggressively pushed back in this. General Mattis aggressively pushing back.
Are they lying?
They are not telling the truth.
Woodward's book echoes that scathing anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, with a top Trump official saying they at times work against the president for the good of the country. More than 24 officials have denied writing it. So will they have to take a lie detector test?
No lie detectors are being used or talked about or looked at as a possibility.
And the White House is trying to crack down on leaks, rolling out a new policy that prevents staffers from taking their phones anywhere near the Situation Room.
Oh, and let's not forget, by the way, the anonymous op-ed that appeared in the New York Times saying that these individuals were part of the resistance. Not the left-wing resistance, mind you, but rather the resistance to Trump basically blowing up the country. Any thoughts?
I actually have Woodward's book.
Oh, you do?
I do. A friend of mine, I'll give a shout out, at the Heidi Report. She gave me the book last night, and I read it last night, and I was reading on the train today.
Wow.
It's very well written. So the way Woodward has – I don't know if you guys have read a Woodward book before. I've read an older one. The way he does it is it's he writes as a narrative, and then anytime there's a quote that he would argue that someone actually said something, he just puts quotation marks around it. But he doesn't do it in a anonymous sources said this, anonymous sources said that. He kind of – he structures it, you know, like Steve Bannon walked into the Oval Office and said this. And you know, and then Trump turned around and said this, and so it's a story. It's very well written, and it opens up with that bombshell that they did the excerpt on, where Gary Cohen stole the memo taking United States out of the South Korean trade agreement.
Yes.
It opens up with that story, and it's a good book. Like I recommend it, and it's a good book because a lot of the books I've tried to read. All the books that have come out except Omarosa's, because as bad as all of my who was the guy that put the first one out, that loser,
what's his name? No,
Michael.
Oh, the wolf. Yes, I've got that one.
I mean, I have that one. It's just trash. The author's trash. The book is trash. Omarosa is trash, and I won't read her book. Sean Spicer's book I saw, and I was just like, there's no way in hell I'm reading that one. Bob Woodward's I'm absolutely reading. It's pretty outstanding. It's taken me back. So right now I'm in 2010 when Trump first wanted to run. I guess he was going to run against Obama. In 2012, and he ended up not doing it. But what's really interesting is some of the Steve Bannon's impression of Trump back in 2012 is that he was incredibly smart, and that impression changed over the subsequent 6 years. So, I mean, I think it leads back to that Trump. You know, it might be an age thing, or there might be something wrong with him because, you know, the stories of Trump back in the day are that, yes, he was an asshole, but he was super smart and super quick. And the stories of President Trump are the exact opposite of that, or that he's got no mental capacity to understand anything and he doesn't retain information. So, I mean, I think there's a medical issue going on here. Then looking at that op-ed, all I'm going to say about that is, you know, whoever wrote that op-ed, screw you, either put your name on it and resign or eat shit, right? Like, that's basically my stance on that.
Wow.
Leanne?
It's harsh. Well, I haven't read the Woodward book yet. Kudos to you, Mike. I'm dying to read it, and I want to get it. But, you know, it's the guy uncovered Watergate. Who do you believe, Woodward or Trump and his lackeys now coming out and denying having said the things I have no doubt that they actually said. As for the anonymous op-ed, I loved it. Like, I'm hanging. When it came out, I almost died. I was, like, freaking while I was reading it. And I'm glad whoever did it, because it's driven him crazy. And if anything can get that guy to just resign, I'm all for it. Having said that, however, why don't you just quit and speak up?
Like, absolutely.
Right? Like, just quit, say who you are, and fight against him out in public, out in the open.
Who do you think it was?
Mike Pence is too stupid to have written anything that intelligent.
Well, he'd have to pull his head out of Trump's ass.
Kellyanne Conway with her husband helping, because her husband openly despises the man.
Yeah, today.
And we already know that she has public, apparently privately, disparages him all the time. And I've always wondered, why are you there? Your husband hates him. You don't seem to like him. Even you must come out and be embarrassed by some of the things that you say. It's like comic relief almost. But people have pointed the finger. I saw a very compelling case that it was John Huntsman because of some of the language, although I think that's a fool's game because, you know, whoever wrote it probably had help writing it. So you can't start saying, well, he says that word all the time.
It was Barron. Right? It was Barron Trump. He wrote it. No, I wouldn't be surprised if it was somebody connected to Pence. That That's the thing. Like,
possibly.
But the
senior White House official can be like a lot of people. That's the other thing. It's impossible.
Well, that's
to
a question.
Figure out
how many would there be, Leanne? Because you've worked in that. Like, what does senior White House official mean?
You can count ambassadors. You can count cabinet secretaries, the vice president, all of his staff. Like, senior White House officials, it could be like 100 people.
Wow.
So, and honestly, I think Omarosa is a tool too, but she had some pretty interesting things to say today on, I guess it was yesterday on The View, about some of the weird things he was doing that really have the ring of truth, like just completely nonsensical. So just barging into meetings, all paranoid and freaking out. And anyway, it's like he's clearly, and that they had a hashtag in their text, the 225A, the 25th Amendment. That they were all communicating with each other in the White House with the hashtag 25A.
One thing that they say in the Woodward book is when Trump did the infamous tape, the Hollywood Access tape, the Republican Party was trying to get him to drop out to put Mike Pence in and then have his running mate who agreed to be Condoleezza Rice.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what they were trying to do.
Really?
Well,
yep. It was going to be Pence and Rice. That was what Reince Priebus had set up after the Hollywood Access tape, but Trump wouldn't drop out.
You know, I would have preferred Rice in the driver's seat rather than Pence, but that would sure be a better situation than they've got right now. Yeah. Also, you're going to laugh at me, and I'm saving this for my story of the day, so I won't get into too much trouble, but I follow Rogue Melania on Twitter, and she's come out with a book.
Oh, I heard that.
Oh my God, you can buy it for $1.99. And at first I thought it was just going to be jokey. And I bought it thinking it would all be in the tortured, you know, whatever is Estonian, Latvian tortured English. But it's actually, somebody has actually written an actual book. It's not very long, about her perspective from inside Trump Tower. And it too, I think that it's an ally of Melania's, and it too has a real ring of truth, like how the Russians basically ordered him to run for president because they wanted to bring down Hillary, and they didn't care whether he won, just that he caused a lot of damage to her and that she would have no mandate and that she'd be a very damaged president who's going to be, you know, constantly hung up in investigations on her emails and Benghazi and whatever else it was. And it honestly, I bought it for $1.99. They sent me the PDF. And I'm enthralled. Anyway, I'll tell you more about it in my story of the week.
Well, I just want to...
Obviously, everybody's coming out. Sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. I want to quote, though, from this, because I want to go back to the original topic, which is, under the Constitution, it is not the job of the White House staff to be the ones trying to control the president. Rather, they are supposed to be exercising the president's will on the country. It's the job of the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress, or Congress generally, to keep the president in check, which they are failing to do. And it is also the job of the cabinet, when you start talking about the 25th Amendment, to look at whether or not the president is fit to contain to maintain his office. In this op-ed in the New York Times by Anonymous, they said the root of the problem is the president's immorality. Anyone who works with him knows he is not moored to any discernible first principles that guide his decision-making. Although he was elected as a Republican, the president shows little affinity for ideals long espoused by conservatives, free minds, free markets, and free people. At best, he has invoked these ideals in scripted settings. At worst, he has attacked them outright. In addition to his mass marketing of the notion that the press is the enemy of the people, President Trump's impulses are generally anti-trade and anti-democratic. Now, if that is coming, let's assume that it's coming from somebody within very close to the president. Where is Congress here? They have a constitution down there. And frankly, if Congress isn't going to stand up, where the hell are the cabinet secretaries standing up? I saw more action on an episode of Madam Secretary when the president had a temper tantrum that was caused apparently by a brain tumor. They revoked his power within 72 hours. This has been going on for 2 years. And at what point does it become not the responsibility of anonymous op-ed writers or White House staff? But when do cabinet secretaries or Congress take their responsibilities to the country over above their loyalty to the president seriously?
Well, they're dirty. That's one of the problems.
Sure.
A lot of them knew that Russia was was financing a lot of the members of the party, that Russia was interfering in the election. A lot of them knew, so they're dirty. And as we've discussed before, they want this dummy in power so they can, you know, change the makeup of the Supreme Court, outlaw, you know, get rid of Roe versus Wade, all that stuff. They've got the perfect dope who has no moral compass whatsoever, has no principles or beliefs. He doesn't believe in anything, as the op-ed writer accurately described him. He just wants to, he's in it for himself. So but he serves a purpose to them for that reason. Like, anyway,
it's very sad.
Everything's going to change after the midterms. Like, it's pretty clear, you know, knock on wood. And I don't say that for partisan purposes, if anybody's listening. It's not like I'm a crazy liberal or a crazy conservative. The guy is neither liberal or conservative, Republican or Democrat. He's a mental case, and he is not just destroying the U.S. reputation worldwide. He's on the brink of, you know, going nuclear on the entire Canadian economy.
Yeah.
So he needs to go. But if the Democrats win the House, which it's largely expected they're going to do, I do believe you're going to start to see them move towards impeachment. And if they also get the Senate, he's done. So we'll see. In the Senate, you need a 2/3 majority. So the Republicans would have to increase their numbers in the Senate. Anyway, I really think it's all going to look very different
in
the months after the midterms.
The Senate will never vote to impeach. Will never vote to impeach unless his, like, I mean, I saw President Bush's.
A Democratic Senate would.
Sure, if they had 68 seats. But they're not going to get 68 seats. They're never going to get it.
But the Republicans have to maintain a 2/3 majority, and they may not do that. So anything, you know, a lot could change after the midterms. And I think he knows that, which is why he's going increasingly crazy, right?
Yeah. Did you see him today when he got off the plane in Pennsylvania, Air Force One? He's sitting there cheering as he sees his supporters. He's there for the Flight 93 memorial service here on 9/11. Just a hell of a guy. He doesn't look the least bit upset, the least bit reflective, and all he tweeted today was 17 years since 9/11.
With an exclamation mark.
Wow. This is also a man, by the way, that on 9/11 bragged about how his buildings would now be the tallest again in New York City now that the Twin Towers had fallen, unreal. So on that happy note, let's switch over to stories of the week, and then we're going to do it a little differently, and then we'll finish off with 9/11. Leanne, why don't you go with your Rogue Melania book?
Well, I follow Rogue Melania on Twitter, and it's very, very funny because this could perhaps make me a very mean person, but I find the tortured prose in which the person behind that Twitter account writes it to be very, very funny. Anyway, so today I see that she's got her own little book for $1.99. If you pay for it, the money will go towards the campaign of the guy who's going against Ted Cruz, who
Beto
apparently
O'Rourke.
I didn't know, she,
Beto
right?
O'Rourke.
Who apparently Melania does not like Rogue Melania. She calls him Ted Goose. Anyway, so I buy it, thinking it's just going to be some funny satire. It all written in the hilarious prose. And it's actually a serious look at why he ran for president in 2015 from her perspective. Like, the person knows the name of the housekeeper and has described the housekeeper and knows what Melania eats every morning for breakfast. And honestly, I actually think it's written by a friend of Melania's. And honestly, for $1.99, read it. It's pretty crazy.
Where did you get it on? Just, was it on eBooks?
I've seen it now. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You just click on the link in her Twitter in her tweet about it, and you can buy it for $1.99. And hello, friend, is me, Rogue First Lady. I make report of what C is. Hope you like and help the Beto make beat of the Ted Goose for Senate in Texas.
Yeah, it literally looks like it was just made on Microsoft Word.
Yes. Is make free sample for you. Try first if want. Is parody from informed perspective. And when you start to read it, the the tortured prose is gone because she claims that she had a servant in the White House help her write it.
She might have. Could be like the White House steward or something.
Like some guy who fucking mops the floors. Yeah, sure, I'll help you. But it, honestly, you start to think, wow, this all makes sense. Like, this might be exactly how it went down and why it went down. So anyway,
well,
if you have, like
John Kelly says, we're living in crazy town. So
if you have an hour and you're willing to spend the $1.99 to help Beto beat Ted the Goose, as she calls him, who she claims she rode in an elevator with him and didn't like him. It's honestly, you start reading it and think, holy smokes, well, that makes sense. Well, that puts the explanation to this. And this explains why he was acting this way. And this explains why the family looked like they all wanted to blow their heads off the night that he actually won the election. Like, it all sort of, she gets into the whole behind-the-scenes stuff going down among the family and in Trump Tower from 2015 on, and it's pretty fascinating. If you're a Trump junkie like I am.
Is the whole thing written, though, in that bad fake accent?
No, it's not. Okay. The intro is, and then she's explaining why it's then written normally, because, you know, the White House butler helped her line edit it, which is, like, no, I think it's a friend of hers. I think it's somebody in her circle, because she actually does have friends. And, you know, they had, in their social circle in New York, she does have some allies. She has people who are apparently really quite worried about her, knows that she never wanted this. And, you know, I think it's one of them. Anyway, give it a read. It's pretty fun.
Will do. Okay, Mike.
Not written in the tortured prose.
Over to you for stories of the week.
Mine's way less boring. Mine's more just a comment that, you know, as we all know, Donald Trump has threatened to, you know, ruin Canada with his auto tariffs. And Justin Trudeau has responded today basically saying, hey, there's going to be some massive disruption in the auto sector because I'm not negotiating with this guy, which is, I don't know. I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm tired of getting kicked around by that guy. Yeah. And I know the Tories would like us to sell out because everything they say basically is like, let them take us. Come on, let them screw us over just so we can have a NAFTA deal. You know what? I say hold strong. And that's why I think his poll numbers are starting to bounce back up, because people are tired of getting kicked around by that asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. He said it in his Trudeau speak. Trudeau talks in his very, you know, how he talks. We all know how he talks. But basically what he's saying is, yeah, I'm not doing this shit, right? Like, there's going to be some disruptions, but you know what? Okay. Like, maybe he thinks that he won't be there for a while. I don't know, but he's saying, okay, let's go.
There's no other way for him to win it. There's no other way for him to play it, right? Like, how, if the conservatives are suggesting that he bows down.
But that's what they are suggesting. That's what they are.
Trash him in the election.
Like, it's just such a losing proposition. Like, no Canadian is going to want to see any politician, no matter if they're NDP, conservative, or liberal, bowing down to Donald Trump. Like, he can't lose by taking that stance. Trudeau, I mean.
Yeah, and Trump wants us to grab our ankles and bend over. Well, no thanks. Like, not going to happen.
The country hates him. Look where he polls in Canada. He's at like 7, like Obama was at 90% for the entire 8 years, and Trump is at 7 or something ridiculous. Like, Canadians hate the guy.
Well, so do Americans. He's at 38% right now in America.
Who are the 7% of Canadians who like this guy? Who are the 7%?
I just made that up. I don't know if it's 7%. Because people voted for Ford. I know people here who have defended Trump to me.
I know Trump fans here.
Well, you were one briefly, Mike, during the dog park era.
That's not true. What I said. Now, okay.
What?
Cameron and I knew each other. Listen, Cameron and I used to go to the same dog park, which is how we know each other. And back in like 2016, but early, let's say like March, we were in the dog park, and I was basically saying to what I said to Cameron, I'll never forget it because it's crazy. I said, Cameron, part of me wants to see Trump win because I want to see what's going to happen. And I said that in jest because we all thought that Hillary was going to win. And in fact, that was before the Republican primary. And I thought Jeb Bush was going to win that primary. I was convinced Jeb was going to win. And I was just going to be like, oh my, because I was just saying, like, it's going to be Bush and Clinton again. This is going to be so boring. Like, I want something funny to happen. Let's have Trump win. And then he did. And Cameron won't let me live it down. I didn't want him to win. I'm not a Trump fanboy, like you're a Bush fanboy. I thought it would be funny, and it's not funny.
Shame on you.
It's not funny.
You know, I had people say that too. Well, at least it'll be entertaining. And I've gone back to those people and said, "Are you entertained?"
Yeah.
They're like, "Oh,
you have
God,
a good laugh."
So sorry. I said,
"I am entertained." Yeah. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, well, I am entertained.
Yeah, but it's like I'm watching. It's like the type of entertainment that a horror movie gives you. like, oh my God, what now?
But not a good horror movie. It's like Scream.
No.
It's like the opening sequence of Scream where you realize, holy shit, this is scary. But then you're kind of like, oh, wait, I think this is a lot of kind of funny, too. It's all very bizarre.
But, you know, we ran a piece on the conversation last week by somebody who talks to lobbyists on both sides of the board, an academic, a trade academic who talks to lobbyists all the time on both sides of the border. And she has insisted in the piece for us that there's absolutely no way that he's going to succeed in kicking Canada out of NAFTA. Like, the interest groups on both sides of the border are so powerful. Like, you got big companies, and well, we know who some of them are, Cameron, because they're on the board of the Canadian American Business Council, like Coca-Cola, right? You've got
yes.
huge companies that are in favor or really pro-Canada in this argument. So he it's just all bluster. And Trudeau probably knows that.
Well, wouldn't be the first time he's blustered. Remember when he asserted how big his penis was? Yeah.
Oh, sure it is. Sure it is.
It's just a little mushroom. Just
What's
a little
story?
Mushroom. My story is a little bit more serious. It has nothing to do with Trump's mushroom appendage or rogue Melania. It has to do with the Brett Kavanaugh hearings that happened. He is, of course, the nominee for the Supreme Court put forward by Donald Trump to replace former Supreme Court Justice on the United States Supreme Court, Anthony Kennedy. And I have two really cool exchanges, one between Kamala Harris, and then there's one between him and Ted Cruz. But I just want you to listen and then we'll talk about it.
Can you think of any laws that give government the power to make decisions about the male body?
I'm happy to answer a more specific question. But
male versus female.
There are medical procedures.
Okay. That the government has the power to make a decision about a man's body?
I thought you were asking about medical procedures that are unique to men.
I'll repeat the question. Can you think of any laws that give the government the power to make decisions about the male body?
I'm not thinking of any right now, Senator.
Another case you were involved in as a judge is you wrote a dissent from denial of rehearing on bonk in the Priest for Life case. Mm-hmm. Can you tell this committee about that case and your opinion there?
That was a group that was being forced to provide a certain kind of health coverage over their religious objection to their employees. And under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the question was, first, was this a substantial burden on the religious exercise? And it seemed to me quite clearly it was. It was a technical matter of filling out a form in that case, but that they said filling out the form would make them complicit in the provision of abortion-inducing drugs that they were, as a religious matter, objected to.
So I wanted to play those two clips because they are at opposite ends here. So the second questioner was Ted Cruz to Brett Kavanaugh. The first one was Democratic Senator from California, Kamala Harris. I thought this was so illustrative. First of all, Roe versus Wade in the United States is under serious threat if this man becomes a justice on the Supreme Court. And chances are he is going to, because the two moderates who could prevent this from happening, GOP Senator Susan Collins and GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski, they are not going to do anything. They're as feckless and cowardly as everybody else.
Susan Collins, though?
Yes, well.
Have you seen the crowdsourcing to, they've raised like $1 million to the guy who's challenging her. So that might have an impact, like, you know.
Well, first of
power
all,
to the people.
Abortion-inducing drugs, he says. He's talking about contraceptives in the second one,
he's
which is ridiculous.
He's talking about Plan B, which isn't an abortion Right? That's not what that drug does. It prevents conception.
Correct. But that apparently is abortion-inducing. But my favorite was was the tumbleweeds that rolled through. There should actually be like a sound effect of wind rolling through. And she says, do you know of anything else, any other, you know, does the government have any say in what a man does? And he just has nothing. And then he tries to play it coy. Anyway, all this to say, I wanted to talk about it just briefly as a story of the week, because I know we have listeners in the United States. And if you are in Maine, and I know we have quite a few in Maine, I would like you to call Senator Susan Collins and register your opposition to this knuckle dragger being put on the Supreme Court by President Pussy Grabber. Her number is 202-224-2523. That is how you can have your say. If you're in Maine, put pressure on Susan Collins and go and find that crowdsource fund that is backing her competitor so that we can get her out of the Senate. Because all moderate GOP or moderate conservatives mean Canadian, American, it doesn't matter. It just means they screw you slower than the other guys who will do it faster and harder. And that's it.
Mm.
Yeah, well, Leanne, sounded pretty good to you, I guess. okay. Let's talk on a more somber note. I wanted to just ask, it's been 17 years since September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
Where were you guys on that day?
I was in my dorm sleeping.
Oh.
Sorry.
I was walking into the newsroom. I was the Ontario Bureau Chief at the Canadian Press. I was walking into the newsroom and we had CP24 on and we could see that one of the buildings was on fire. And I remember saying, you know, because Greenpeace had been doing stupid shit in the previous couple few months. They've been putting banners on buildings and stuff like that. And I remember saying, oh, is it stupid Greenpeace trying to hang one of their banners on the World Trade Center and they crash? And just as I was saying that, the other one came in.
Oof.
The other one, poof, and it was like, holy shit. And at the time, I was in a relationship with somebody whose sister worked in the World Trade Center, the second one that got hit, and we didn't hear from her for 3 or 4 hours. So that was a bit, and we watched them come down.
Where was she? Was she on one of the top floors or middle?
She was right below where the second plane hit.
Come on.
And but they had started to evacuate when the first tower got hit, because they were there when they tried to set the bomb a few years earlier, right? She'd been in the building and she was actually the floor manager. And she said, we are getting in. They're like, oh no, it sounds like it was just an accident. Her colleagues. And she is like, I'm sorry, we are getting out of this building and we're getting out of this building now. So she insisted that they all leave. So they're just sort of coming out of the building. They're just at like the third or fourth floor as they've gone down the stairs to get out of the second tower. And they feel the plane hit.
Is that right?
That's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and then they just ran the hell up whatever that street is in Lower Manhattan and got out of there. But by that time, then all the cell coverage was done, and she couldn't reach her family, and it was chaos. So for 4 hours, his family did not know where she was, so it was very scary.
Wow.
Anyway, that was my story.
I always wondered, you know, how they didn't come down right away when the planes hit, because that is a massive impact with those planes hit. But at any rate, I was up on Parliament Hill right by the Peace Tower. That I was working for the chief government whip, Marlene Catterall, at the time, and we were sitting right up on Parliament Hill. I could see the Peace Tower like out of my office window. And I remember, of course, nobody knew what was going on. And as soon as I remember calling my mom in BC from the office, and waking her up, and it was 6 o'clock and she thought I was joking. And I said, no. And then by then the Pentagon was on fire. And then I think, and Michael probably think it's just me being pro President Bush here, but I think actually what scared me the most, well, obviously what was going on TV, but it was very surreal not to be able to find the president. Like nobody knew where he was.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like
and
you saw.
Must have been very painful for you. It must have been particularly traumatic for you.
It was.
He was just like, "What is Barbara thinking?"
Well, Barbara would be his mom.
Your icon, your object of your love and admiration gone for hours.
No, but I think you know what? It was just very surreal. It's like something you saw in a movie, right? Because they had him going, he went from Florida to somewhere in Louisiana, then he went to Nebraska, and then he had to like basically order them to take him back to the White House because they weren't going to let him.
Really mad. He didn't want to be. He wanted to be in the White House right from the beginning. So I read that years later, and I kind of had a bit of admiration for him.
Well, that's why he came back, right?
He was portrayed. Do you remember? Remember the news story of what a coward he went into hiding, right? And he really didn't. He was really pissed that they made him go into hiding. He wanted to be back in the White House.
I think I remember reading in his book Decision Points that he said something to the effect that they. And I think it probably was on the news as well that they really thought that it was a decapitation strike, that they were trying to take out like the senior leaderships of the United States very, very quickly, which is why everybody kind of, and remember Cheney was gone for months. Like you wouldn't see them in the same room at all. Anyway, all that to say, my whole point was it was a very scary moment. And I just, you know, 17 years later, we're still living with the effects of 9/11, and whether you take your shoes off at the airport, whether it's the profiling that goes on, even if it's the way some people look over their shoulders at people around the corner, sitting beside them. I mean, we are a post 9/11 age, and it's very surreal to me that it happened.
The world definitely changed, and it has forever changed Canada U.S. relations too, because it's still people still believe they came through Canada. Like that was a diehard thing that I have reported on that so often when I was in Washington, even though they did not.
Right.
But it affected the border security issues and my kids. Like my kids were, oh God, don't make me do the math, but they were young, like maybe 12 and 8. And it has totally, they have come up in a totally different world than I came up in. Like everything changed for them. They view the world differently than I do. They travel differently than I do. Like we were really lucky. We grew up in a pretty freewheeling age, or at least I'm older than you guys, but you know, like it's different for the kids.
Well, but
it was a significant historical event, and there's been two in my life. So there was the fall of communism, the Berlin Wall, and September 11th. On September 11th, I was in my dorm and I was sleeping, and I had just written a paper on terrorism, and I did talk about the first bombing of the World Trade Center, right? So when it happened, I remember thinking like, I wonder if this is Osama bin Laden again, because I knew who he was because I had just done a paper on him, right? So then I remember running to the history department of my university and being like, the professors there, because that's the faculty I was in, just saying like, hey, have you guys seen what's going on? And you're right. It significantly changed everything. I mean, it was the first time in history that article, and the only time that Article 5 of NATO was implemented. Are you aware of that?
Yes, it is the only time in NATO's
only
history.
Only time in NATO's history that Article 5
and
was
when the Canadian And the Canadian NATO commander was briefly in charge of the whole caboodle for a few days. But the other interesting thing about that day is that you knew as soon as you realized what had happened that the world was going to change, right? It wasn't like anything was ever going to go back to normal after that. That was what was weird about it.
Well,
like I remember the days following where all the planes were grounded and the skies were silent.
It was quiet.
So strange.
It is very, yes.
Weird. And you just knew, I just felt this feeling of dread, which is actually, it's not been since then. Thanks, Trump. That I had felt that same feeling of dread that something terrible is going to happen if we don't get this situation under control. I feel that way now. But the last time I felt that way was in the days and weeks after 9/11.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's unsettled time. And I think, you know, the people that have been born since then, I mean, there are kids now. I mean, my nephews were born after 9/11. They will never understand the, you know, I hate to say shock and awe of it, but it's still to this day, I just remember the sick, you know, I mean, and I obviously wasn't down there, but the way that it felt on 9/11 to see those planes and to the confusion and everything that happened subsequent, and just the way the world kind of came together, and they really did. I mean, I also remember too a story that Bush told in his book that said that, and you would never see this now, Vladimir Putin called him because they knew that the U.S. would have to increase their increase their defense exercises around that area or whatever, or do stuff in the skies. And he called Bush and told him that he was having the Russian Air Force stand down and whatever he needed at that time. Like there was no question of them viewing it as a threat. He reached out himself and said, you know what? I'm not going to, don't worry about it. Anything you need, the airspace is yours. And that never happens. Nowadays, Nowadays, you know, we everything seems serious, but so much less serious because of the person in the White House. But On 9/11, I do want us all to remember the people that fell and were fallen and the lives that were lost and the way that we all changed. And so on that note, we're going to end today. After
cheerful.
I say goodbye to you two, we are going to end with President Bush and President Obama's speech, speaking before football game a couple of years ago on the 15th anniversary, but it still holds true now. So I will bid you two goodbye, and we will
take
talk next week. And over to you,
arrivederci.
President Obama and Bush.
As the years go by, September the 11th, 2001, can seem like part of a different era. But for the nearly 3,000 families whose loved ones were stolen, the memory of that morning is fresh, and so is the pain. So on this solemn anniversary, we remember the innocent souls who boarded flights, showed up for work at the World Trade Center, reported for duty at the Pentagon, and started their shifts at police and fire stations. Today we honor them and salute their families, especially their children, whose lives have come to embody America's resilience and hopefulness, our compassion, and our light.
It's up to all of us to carry forward their legacy. Whenever confronted by cowards who seek to destroy, America chooses to be strong and build a better future. It's why so many of our fellow citizens spend this National Day of Service and Remembrance by giving back to their communities or paying forward a simple good deed. That's the spirit we saw after those terrible attacks. That's how we build an America that reflects our values, freedom and opportunity, compassion, openness, and acceptance for all our citizens. That's the work that falls to each of us, today and every day.